So welcome everyone to Anarchism 101, which is a panel discussion about different kinds of anarchism. So it's not a debate between these three people here. There's just three representatives of different strands of anarchism. So we've got Paul from Anarchist Federation, we've got Mike from Solidarity Federation, and we've got Donald from Sophia, who's talking about green anarchism. So we're going to start off with Paul from Anarchist Federation. And sorry, just to say, they're going to do short contributions, just saying a little bit about their kind of anarchism, and then we'll open it up. And it is a question and answer session, so we'll start off with questions, and then if people want to make short contributions later. So we'll just have a brief few words from each of the panel members here.
I'm just trying to look round here and see who knows about the Anarchist Federation here. Oh, power. Everyone puts their hands up, isn't it great? Okay. All right. So you mostly know about the Anarchist Federation, so I don't really need to go into the huge detail about it. I suppose the key thing is that we see the need for anarchism to be organised. If revolution is created by the working class in its own interest, which we believe it is, then there's still a need for a political organisation. Because the political consciousness that is developed by the working class, part of that is in the organisations that class has, and we see ourselves as being part of that. We're organised around the country. I think it's about 14, 15 different AF groups now in the country, and we produce a paper once a month and a magazine twice a year and pamphlets and publications, but we also do other stuff as well. I mean, this book fair has, I think, although it's not been organised by Sheffield Anarchist Federation, I know Sheffield Anarchist Federation have played a huge part in getting it going. Similarly in Manchester, the book fair over there is something that's, I wouldn't put it quite a creature of the AF, but the AF is one of the prime movers in it. There was recently a feminist, an anarcho-feminist weekend in Manchester. Again, AF members played a part in organising that. Not the whole of it, not the most of it, but they played a part in it. We do try and organise in our federation around the areas, the interests that our members have got. So we've got a women's caucus and an LGBTQ caucus. We're beginning to look in terms of the areas of we work in now. So looks likely that there's going to be an education workers, an education corps being formed soon, and people who are active in that area, either workers or students, and trying to push and develop specific anarchist politics in that area. We try and work closely with other anarchist organisations and other class struggle organisations as well. It's not like we're the only the only source of anarchist ideas. I mean, I'm sat here with Comrade from Solidarity Federation. It's a group that we work very closely with, particularly in Manchester, which is where I'm from. I know little about the other comrades sat on the other side of me, but no doubt if we were in the same area, we would be working together as well. Our members have played a part at recent climate camps, organising social centres, industrial disputes. Or we in Manchester have been organising at work recently, organising, there's two of us in my workplace, can't go into too much details, big dispute recently. Two of us there managed to organise mass meeting of all the workers present, cutting across the union boundaries. Managed to do it from two different workplaces with the same employer, which, although the gains we got from it were small, nonetheless we did get significant gains that probably would not have been achieved if we hadn't enforced that. And it's the kind of politics that we develop and we discuss and we debate within our organisation which gives us the nous, as it were, to push for that in our workplaces. We really seriously want to build the federation. We want to make it bigger. We want to make it stronger. We think the more people that are part of what we do, then the faster our ideas will spread. And at the moment, there's a crying need for a clear set of class-conscious anarchist views that are being portrayed. particularly since the recent election and the moves towards austerity that are without any doubt coming, and the attacks that we're going to be facing as workers, as students, as women, as gays, as whatever, the attacks that we're going to be facing in the coming years beg a description. So anyway, that will do for now.
Thanks.
I'm from Solidarity Federation. Solidarity Federation is an anarcho-syndicalist organisation that's a member of the International Workers Association. We're a very small organisation, although we do work closely, certainly in West Yorkshire, with AFED. The main things we've been involved in recently are the defending the attacks on anarchists around the world, in particular in Serbia and in Germany, where comrades of ours have been imprisoned, and the German Union, the independent union, has been basically outlawed for all intents and purposes. We're mainly involved in industrial strategies, so we try to organise within the workplaces. We're getting very involved in the public sector at the moment because obviously they're facing massive cuts, and we're trying to organise within that. Apart from that, we pretty much are very similar to Anarchist Federation. We have similar views and we do a lot of actions together. That's about it, really.
Okay, thank you.
Green Anarchism doesn't really have an organisation as such. It's a different model that complements a lot of what's going on. We just work in different spheres. We tend to work more along the lines of networks. So the Earth First Network would be a classic Green Anarchist inspired group. Similarly with Radical Roots, Housing and Trading Co-ops Network it's got very strong roots in Green Anarchism. And other big events which Green Anarchism inspired and has major influence would be stuff like Stirling Eco Village and the climate camps. The founding groups for most of those events were actually populated by Green Anarchists. So while we don't have any sort of formal structures, we are generally out and about. I think our philosophies do differ. I'm not saying they contradict each other, but rather than being focused necessarily just purely on class or workplace struggles, one big strand of Green Anarchism is personal liberation. So it took a lot of influence from early liberation struggles, which very greatly fell into it, feminist thought, stuff like that. So there's a lot of that sort of personal development and personal questioning of, you know, capitalism, you know, not just saying capitalism is bad, but how we individually play roles in that and are socialised and trying to break down those sort of boundaries. The other big difference between Green Anarchism is that we challenge very much what's known as the anthropocentric viewpoint, i.e. humans at the centre of all political, economic stuff. You know, we try to take a more holistic, bigger picture and bring the environment, bring ecology in, and understand our relationship. To say there's no... As a movement, we are very diverse. There's no one coherent theory that dominates. You know, some quite most people consider quite extreme positions, such as primitivism, all the way to social ecology, which is to say humans are the problem, capitalism is the problem affecting environment. So it's a very, very broad church of political ideas that somehow seems to come together and work.
Okay, so if we can take initial questions to any of the three panel members. Anything that's not clear, anything you'd like to have clarified, or any pre-existing question you had before you came here today? Yeah.
What do you think are the main differences between AFED and the Solidarity Federation? I know it's a bit of a pricey question.
It's always a difficult one to answer. From my personal point of view, the main difference is the Anarchist Federation tends to be, we were discussing this earlier, more political, and we're more industrial. So we tend to try to organise more amongst the workplace, amongst the workers. And I hope I'm right on that. And AFED, it tends to be very political. I don't know, we were sort of discussing it earlier. It's a very fine line between us. So there's a lot of discussions going on at the moment about the differences and how we can overcome them, really.
Yeah, differences between the Anarchist Federation and the Solidarity Federation. At times, there can appear to be not many differences between us. It tends, I think, to revolve around our understanding of what is possible and what is practical at the moment. Yeah, we would like to see mass organisation of workers in the workplaces. We would like to see mass networks of workers in the workplace struggling for improvement of their working lives and ultimately the overthrow of capitalism. Yeah? But we think that the workplace isn't the only place where the working class needs to do that. It needs to be done in the places we live. It needs to be done in areas of our life, in other areas of our life where the state and where capital oppress and exploit us. That can be in our families, in our relationships with other human beings, in our relationship with the planet. Yeah. So we would take many Anarchist Federation members took an active part in the climate camps, and that was done after discussion in the Anarchist Federation as it being something worth doing. Many members of the Anarchist Federation are active in LGBTQ struggles, and increasingly now members of our federation are active around anarcho-feminism. Yeah? So it's about organising not just in the workplace but in other areas as well, that we would like to build a strong workplace organisation. And just at the moment, I would think that we think that's not something that there's enough of us, if we put all our efforts into, would produce that much goods. Yeah. Okay. And we do not want to build a mass permanent union that will be representing other workers.
Okay, over there.
Do you want me to answer that one?
Do you want to start?
Anyone? Okay. No. If you ask me what I am, I'll tell you I'm a communist. If you ask me what I am, I'll tell you I'm an anarchist. Communism to me is a kind of a society where there is organised in a particular way, where there are no bosses and there are no owners and there is no working for wages. There is no production for exchange. Right, where production is for use and for satisfying human need. Anarchism is a view of the organisation of society where you can only achieve a truly free society without a state machine, with a small minority of people dominating society. So if you ask me to be subtle about it, I say I'm an anarchist communist. Yeah. What was labelled communism in the past was a form of capitalism where the state ran everything. Yeah? And unfortunately, the ideas behind that, they go back many, many years, and they are embedded in political thought for the last 200 years. Some political thought we take some positive messages from, but that's getting very complicated, yeah? Okay.
Okay, Don, did you want to...
I think... From a green anarchist perspective, we just take, one definition of anarchism is libertarian communism. So you've got the two tensions within anarchism of whether society should focus around the collective or should it focus around the individual. And those are different tensions across anarchism. So when we it's really down to the individual groups and just perspectives and where they see they fit in. Generally, when people mention communism, it is pretty much on that sort of state capitalist. When the original Marx was talking about was essentially going towards anarchism, and he says that state should wither away. It's just that they needed a state in order to actually wither away and get to overthrow. Well, as anarchists, we say, well, that's always going to be a self-replicating problem, so we just need to get rid of the state itself. So it depends, yeah, a lot of what you actually, how you define communism for yourself, and is it that Marxist-Leninist tradition or the more libertarian tradition that was of Bakunin?
I mean, Salford, we also consider ourselves anarchist-communist. We believe in mutual aid, which is the communism. We believe that people should work together. But we also believe in personal freedom. And we believe that one without the other doesn't work, basically. Because if you have anarchism without the communist part, it tends to be one for themselves. And if you have the communism without the anarchist part, it tends to be state-run and top-down. So we believe that you need to have both together in order to basically progress.
Would anarchism have got so far today without the free Russian aristocrats, Tolstoy, Kropotkin and Bakunin?
Yes.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because the politics that we have, partly you read somebody like, I've not read Tolstoy, right?
Really?
I've read bits of Kropotkin and bits of Bakunin, and I read it and I think, yeah, that sort of jibes with what I think. But for me and for our federation, far more important than the writings of people like that is the actual reality of what working class people have achieved in struggle, what the actual reality of what people have fought for on the land and what they've done. And we get far more inspiration from that than we ever do from reading guys with big beards who had little castles in Russia, you know. And I say that slightly flippantly, but you could look at the Spanish Revolution in 1936 there, and that wasn't aristocrats, that was workers and that was peasants, you know, taking on the state and doing it for themselves. And I bet they'd never read Bakunin, yeah. And we can learn far more from them, or we can learn far more from what the workers and peasants in Russia did in 1917 and 1918 than we can ever learn from Kropotkin or Marx or any of those other guys.
Yeah, so it's like they're having, you know, I think when people talk about Kropotkin and Bakunin, we're falling into a classic cult personality. We need somebody to articulate anarchism, but I agree with just being said, it's like people have been articulating anarchism in many ways even before them. It's like even before Bakunin, and so you could say Proudhon, and people have gone further back. Certainly I'd say to my mind, anarchism will arise naturally as people start questioning. The more you question, the more you come to, you think anarchism is a coherent way forward. So we don't particularly need a cult of personality for it to exist.
I agree with what's been said. I think
I agree with Nick.
Yeah. Alexander Bateman said that it's natural progression, that anarchism is natural progression, that each time we overthrow the masters we get closer and closer, and eventually we'll get to it. And I pretty much agree with him. I think that he's right. You don't need the big thinkers as such, it's just natural progression. Human nature eventually means we live and destroy ourselves or live by mutual aid. So
Any other questions? Okay, or any contributions that people want to make themselves? Any responses to what's been said? Any disagreements or embellishments?
Taking away, saying we're not the centre of the universe, does that also take away our power to sort of take the
responsibility and say, well, we can't do it for you as well. By saying, well, does that not leave room for people who say, oh, well, it's just a natural thing and you know, it's happened. Look at these graphs that I've got and it happens over the years and we haven't done anything to it, it's all going to sort itself out. Does that not open
it up? In a limited sense, it is open to that sort of interpretation, but you know, when we talk about mutual aid and solidarity, rather than just expressing it to a one-to-one level or a collective level, but actually opening that to what's known as a wider consciousness, to say, well, we are responsible for this, we have to take responsibility. But it's not just saying, yes, holding our hands up and saying, yeah, we screwed up, we mucked up the planet, sorry, lads. We must actually go out and reevaluate our relationships with it. And one of the ways to challenge that is this sort of Judeo-Christian tradition that, you know, God created man, then God created woman, and everything follows from that natural. And that tradition is very, very strong in our thinking. And one of the things that's been anarchist is actually to try and step outside that that tradition, and just constantly reevaluating our relationships, not just with other humans, but with the wider environment. And also, just from even if you are going to take a very human-centric point of view, it's like, we can talk about the workplaces in the UK and just focus on workplaces in the UK, not realising that they've got massive impacts on the lives of other people around the world. So we say, just to be slightly controversial, so let's say we challenge, say, talk about steel workers, and you support about steel workers. And as green anarchists, the first thing I would say is, where's the ore coming from? You know, it's not just the people at the Ravenscar, the various factories in the UK. It's the wider picture. It's looking at what's happening in Chile and Bolivia and other places where the ore is mined. Saying, well, they've got rights. They've got needs that need to be respected. We must look at that in a much more, you know, show mutual aid on that sort of level rather than just ignoring what's anything outside the immediate workplace.
Yeah, I think for myself, the problem is that we have neither responsibility nor control over for what's happening in the world at the moment. Everything seems to be outside of our control. It's like the machine that is capitalism dictates the exploitation and the destruction that's going on. And as much as we individually hate it and want to do something about it, as long as we're fighting on our own, we're incapable of making any real significant changes. I recycle like the best, you know, and I do everything I can. And I know it's a drop in the ocean. I know that unless we actually collectively make a decision to make a change in society, then we're never going to be in a position where we can take responsibility for the mess that human beings make of the planet. Because at the moment, capitalism is in control, and capitalism is making us make that mess. Yeah.
Without getting rid of capitalism, without the idea of mutual aid, we'll never live in harmony with the planet anyway. We can't, because it's all based on consumption. And while we consume, we're going to exploit the planet. So, similar views with the sort of green anarchists, are just different ways of getting to the end result.
I would say, to go back to within green anarchism, is that there, for example, the social ecology trend would be very much in line with what Solvay and AFL's approaches. On the other hand, you have people like, say, the primitivists or deep ecologists who are saying, well, actually, we need to step away in a very, very different way. And the workplace is part of, they would say, the workplace is part of the problem. And actually just questioning that. There's no real consensus. These are all still actively being discussed. So you can't give one answer and say, we believe this. You'll find all sides in the debate.
One and then two.
Sorry,
yep.
My friend's okay. She's got a test.
Sorry, say that again.
My friend's asking what time the book for.
Yeah, over there.
I just interested in your opinion on in an anarchist society, how would
blood was made to feel sorry for their actions in a society where there's no police and there's no, straightforward law against it. But yeah, I'd just be interested if you were, to all of you.
It's always one of the difficult questions. One of the things is that you've got to look at why murders happen. And it has been put forward by various philosophers that a lot of murders are put forward because of the state that we're living in. And so if you take that away, that would obviously automatically put down the amount of crime in general. To say getting rid of the police, it's always something people always come and say, oh, you want to get rid of the police. You want to get rid of the police as a state function. It doesn't mean there won't be people who, like in Spain, have the militias. Because as human beings, we do tend to sort of do things differently to other people, so there has to be some sort of way of dealing with things. It's not a clear answer, though. There's a lot of discussion going on, certainly in Salford. We've been having a lot of discussions about crime and punishment within our local. But I do believe that there are ways around it. Just to say, murderers, you've got to look at why people are murdering, why people are doing all the crimes that are happening. If you can get rid of a lot of those crimes in the first place, you've already cut it down massively.
I hate that question. I mean, partly because how do you answer it? We're living in an antisocial society where theft and power are the norm, where stealing is the norm, where doing other people down is the norm, and is in fact celebrated, on television and in society. You're successful if you're powerful, you're successful if you cheat, you're successful if you rob, you get to be queen in the end, don't you? And so that, and then we make people live in small houses on top of people they don't necessarily want to be with. We have relationships based on that have sort of an unnatural basis to them with other people. And from time to time, there's explosions like that terrible case that happened in Spain over the weekend. Last week, the woman who killed her children. Why did she kill them? She killed them because her husband has been taken back to England because he's a pedo, and she's worried that she's going to lose her children, so she killed them. She's cracked up. Now, how could an anarchist society deal with her except in a compassionate way? What's she going to want to do now? She'll probably want to go and kill herself. So how could we cope with somebody like that? On the other hand, in my local paper, I read about there was a guy got beaten up on the bus just because he wouldn't give a couple of lads a cigarette because he didn't have it, and he got his head cracked and now suffers from blackouts. I don't know how a society would deal with those people. I can think that in a period immediately after a change, immediately after a revolution, the society might deal quite harshly with the young men who beat the guy on the bus. I can imagine that as time went on and as new social relations developed, those kind of acts of violence would become less frequent. Yeah. Therefore, the way they're dealt with would change. I don't know what quite harshly means. It might mean locking them up and keeping them out of harm's way for a while. It might mean re-education in a place where they can't get hold of alcohol. It might mean putting them into stocks and throwing things at them. I don't know, but it's something that would have to be decided at the time. But I do know that as society changed and moved on, then the kinds of acts of antisocial behaviour would change and the kind of response to it would change. But yeah, in a time of social change, it could be dealt with quite harshly. Though I think the example of the woman who murdered her children, she would, I'd hope, would be dealt with compassionately. Yeah? It's dip horses for courses, I suppose.
Okay, I'm going to let Don come in, and then I've got a couple of questions. So it's yours to direct.
It's 2 o'clock, Leo.
Okay, so still on the same question, and then I've got 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay.
I think again, there's no easy answer, but the first thing is to look at: we live in a society where punishment's done through coercion. and state control, so any solutions are going to have to acknowledge that. There are other systems of theories of justice, such as restorative justice, and there are groups, for example, there's a group in America that's dealing with a rapist. Rather than ostracising them from the groups, they're setting down a set of guidelines and getting to acknowledge his behaviour and dealing with it in a very inclusive way, rather than necessarily just chucking him out. Green anarchism again has quite a different attitude. That's quite common. This is quite a common question that comes up, and especially around in primitivism, where people think we should go back to a very tribal lifestyle. People will point to the norms that exist in small tribal groups. Now, I'm not a primitivist, so I'm maybe not the best person to argue this, but they would point to say that part of the problem is that we live in groups that are too big, that are too unnatural, we don't know everybody, and that what's needed is a complete restructuring of society. So that we get smaller collectives. Saying that there is hopefully a project starting up in Oxford soon, looking precisely at the issue of justice within anarchist circles. But yes, it's the white elephant in the room that a lot of people just try not to deal with.
Okay. Yes.
Right. I don't like blueprinting how anarchist society is going to deal with crime and punishment, but there is the old adage that the prevention is better than the cure. And speaking, for example, of economic crimes, now, I personally shoplift, and I don't do it because it's co-op, because of my politics, I shoplift out of need. And punishment doesn't stop the shoplifting. What will stop the shoplifting is being able to get food and things I need for free. And it's the same with theft. I mean, like, the people who needed the sink, that must have smacked that guy's head in. They can have all the sinks they want under communism. And speaking of, like, social crimes, like, for example, rape, look at like, what causes someone to want rape is generally the fact that they have got really fucked up view of their position as a gender male or gender female and what a member of the opposite sex really is. Now we're going to have to tackle patriarchy and restrictive gender values, and therefore people's perceptions thereof. So therefore, hopefully people have less sexual hang-ups, and people be less constrained, and they'll have less intention to release it.
Okay. Yeah.
This is a response rather than. I think the main thing with the question of crime is you can't give one view because crime's a million different situations and each community will probably act with it in a different way as long as other communities tolerate each other, and they'll come to different agreements how that is, I can imagine anyway. In coming to these agreements, it's that community that will deal with it. So asking one of us now to go, well, how will X community in 30 years in the future deal with this? It's an impossible question because we're not there. Even if we are existing in that time, we might have a different culture because we live in a different world and built up different perspectives of looking at things. So it's almost like an irrelevant question.
I think one of the things, if we're talking about crime, I think we've got to sort out the various concepts involved in that. First of all, I think if we're looking at crime, we've got to look at, first of all, my definition of crime is things that are against the law. Now, there are some things that I would describe as virtues in the present society are considered to be crime. What I'm against is social harms. Now, really, if that is the case, how are we going to deal with it? The current society seems to have, when people break the law, and their idea of stopping crime is to punish people afterwards. I think a libertarian approach to crime would more like trying to stop social harms in the first place. I think one of the things here, somebody over there raised the question of rape. I think, really, we start looking at that and we start dealing with it and trying to stop it. I would have thought one of the first things that we would advocate is that people have the right to self-defence. And I think that one of the things that we should do as regards women and other vulnerable groups, we should help them to defend themselves against these attacks and this abuse. I think also what we get to a large extent would appear that a lot of people are perpetrating abuse are really quite high up in the social hierarchy of the country. As a boy, I was indecently assaulted by the priest. Now, I think that one of the things there, that the people are in those positions of power, because basically that's what it is, something should be done about removing from the position of power. In a lot of cases, if we're talking about rape, in most cases, people who are raped know who's the one who did it. The idea of stranger danger, and this is the same thing as regards the sexual abuse of children, in a lot of cases it is known to the person who is suffering the assault. So I think this is one of the things that we do in the first place there. And certainly I think one of the things as well, because if we're talking about crimes of a sexual nature, one of the things is we've got to mount an attack on the hypocritical, self-serving attitudes of the Catholic Church and other religious bodies as well. Sorry, that's more like a spin.
That's all right.
All I was going to say is kind of in response, when I find people bring up the question of how would anarchism deal with crime, is that if you look at the way the state deals with it, is, well, they deal with it after the fact. As you were saying, if we're talking about murder, the person's already dead. I mean, that's the crime. That's the real problem, is that someone's wound up dead when in all ways they shouldn't be. And I think that when dealing with that problem is, it needs to be about prevention, doesn't it? I think the one key benefit of anarchism is that by creating a better community and a stronger sort of added cohesion between people, is that you're going to prevent a lot of crimes, and that the crimes that do happen are going to be ones that the current system doesn't prevent either. So it's kind of, we don't really lose out, we gain.
Thank you.
Hello. I'd like to come back up what was probably a slip of the tongue from Rob, and hoping it was a slip of the tongue, with your reference to women as a vulnerable group.
I said, I think women and vulnerable
are there,
groups.
Are there vulnerable groups?
Yes.
Which is kind of assuming, first of all, that women are a group and not half the world's population. And secondly, that women are vulnerable. Women are only as vulnerable as their place in society and can be as strong as anybody else. Men are vulnerable too. More young men get attacked and beaten up on a Saturday night as a result of too much fucking alcohol on the streets. More young men get stabbed than women. More young men end up on a fucking morgue slab than women. The business about women and rape, yes, okay, I'll let you have that one. In the church, I would say probably more boys got raped than girls by the priest bastards. Yeah. So it's not just women who are vulnerable. Men are vulnerable too. We are all equally vulnerable when we are placed in positions when people are pissed or stoned or under severe pressure because of the system that we live under. So. I think it was a slip of the tongue, and I'm not sure it probably was, but I think people need to be careful about how they use language and refer to how we refer to each other and how we use language.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm not actually directly responding to any of these.
I think that's fine. Are there any direct responses before we move off this how we deal with crime issue, antisocial actions? Yes, that direct response, yeah?
I'll just kind of, it kind of builds on what's been said so far. Given that a lot of crime will be prevented by having a better, a fairer, a nicer society under anarchy, then the rest of the crime that occurs is going to be something that having that society doesn't compensate for in someone, some need in the person that isn't fulfilled by having that society. And I think in those cases, it's likely to be kind of, there's likely to be a mitigating circumstance, I think. And so you can look at the current system, how it's kind of moving from punishment to rehabilitation in terms of how it deals with crime, slowly, I'll give you that, and not very successfully, but idealistically it's trying to do that. And kind of think that the crime that would occur in an anarchist society would be the sort that would be best responded to by rehabilitation or by kind of community-based solutions rather than a punishment approach to crime once it's happened.
Okay, moving on then.
I was wondering how everyone on the panel, and just generally how everyone felt about, we look at the world and we've got the red tie shirts and a tie red shirt, red tie shirt, tie dye, and all of the demonstrations in Greece, South America has always been sort of bubbling under, and yet Britain, we just seem to love, is it just that we love to moan and we don't want to do anything about it? Because we've just been completely pillaged over the past, like, at the one point, the best example that we have in living memory of how capitalism does not work and is a self-defeating system, and yet nothing revolutionary-wise. We've still got people rioting in the poll tax alive, surely, if anyone made it out of that. I was just wondering how everyone felt in terms of why hasn't anything been done, and have we failed in that respect?
Okay. Because nothing has actually happened. We're still living in this massive bubble. Economically, we haven't seen a proper recession yet. We are still toddling along, you know, things. There's so many grenades in the system waiting to go off, and the government's just been spending billions and billions propping up the economy. So we're still in disillusion. Most people are in this illusion that it's okay to remain in debt, that it's things are going to get better. You know, the government's talking, oh, we're returning to growth, blah, blah. People are falling for this propaganda. We're in an incredibly dangerous position economically that could topple. And that's to me is when the spark will happen. At the moment, we're still in the bubble. What's happened in Greece, what's happened in Ireland, you know, that could just hasn't happened here yet, but potentially could. Looking from the economics, thinking over the next, by putting my neck on the line, by the time 2013, we shall have seen massive cuts that are unavoidable. And this is my critique of Greece and all these other places. Like, they're trying to say the government, you know, stop cutting these jobs, blah, blah, blah. There is no money. You know, we're under this illusion if we think there's enough money out there to actually preserve the system as it is, that we can continue going, spending and racking up the same sort of debt that we have. And our society is built on debt. There's very little money actually in the system that's genuine. And we're just perpetuating this loop. And the longer we perpetuate it, the bigger the fall is going to be. And start hints at that, like this week, underlying inflation went up to 5%. Massive jump, and you know, those ripples, those shakes are going through the economy. And if we're ready, if we're organised, then we're in a position to actually do something about it. And to me, the actual question is, are we ready for the challenge of when the crisis actually kicks in properly? You know, that's what we should be organising towards.
Okay,
can I
take a moment there?
Yeah, sorry, I just had a response to that. I think there's a couple of things I'd say to that. First of all, I don't think it's necessarily true that financial hardship is a necessary corollary to struggle. There's plenty of examples in history where workers have experienced horrendous amounts of deprivation and misery and have not been particularly militant. And there's also plenty of examples of workers who are even fairly well off who have still struggled extremely hard to make further gains from the system. And the second thing I would say also is that if you look at what's happening in Greece with the working class there, or what's happening in Ireland, or anywhere in the world where workers are struggling, purely in terms of the finances that are involved, in terms of things like government debt, social debt in general, then you're sort of missing the point in a way. Because despite the whole apparatus of capitalist finance on which the system is built to an extent, you have to realise that what's actually behind it all isn't finance or money or anything like that, but something much more concrete. It's actual physical goods and services that are produced by real people. And those things exist. They exist in abundance, and they could exist in much greater abundance if the means they existed were used differently. Shaking your head there, but I'm going to finish. And if workers actually demand the concrete things that they need, rather than demanding forms or bailouts or anything of that nature, then we can actually make significant gains. And if we're in a position to take charge of our own human needs ourselves, then even if the financial system implodes because of it, it won't matter, because we'll have reached the stage by that point where we can manage what we actually need to manage ourselves. Perfectly effective.
I mean, the thing is, there isn't actually the money to match up with all those goods. No, there isn't all those goods to match up with the money. When banks have been taking loans out, they've been taking maybe 6,000 bank pounds from the central bank to bolster a £150,000 loan, and that money never actually exists, so there's no products correlating to it. When that loan fails, they've lost £150,000, but it didn't ever actually exist.
The problem with capitalism is in the real economy, not just in its financial expression. So to that extent, that's true. But at the end of the day, we can't gradually sort of build up some kind of alternative economy within the framework of capitalism, because it is a global integrated system. So it's true that in the course of large-scale struggle, there is a potential to take over real wealth in the sense of literally, as I'm sure a lot of people here will agree, to literally take over what we need in the way of land, in the way of, you know, computers, in the way of all the things we need to actually look after our own interests and maintain ourselves. But that is a situation of mass struggle, and it has to be sparked by something, and the economic crisis that's been referred to is surely that spark. Now, the problem is it doesn't mean, you know, it could equally lead to reactionary outcomes, you know what I mean? There's nothing automatic about it in that sense, and so we can't be overly optimistic, but equally it would be false to think that, you know, we can somehow create a new world just by adding another half dozen people every time we meet an anarchist book to our particular ideological frame of mind or ideological grouping, because we'd never get anywhere on that basis, would we? So the problem, I think, you know, our green anarchist speaker is right in one sense, that there's an element of being prepared for the potential that arises out of struggles that will and are happening in response to the current crisis, which will develop and is global, because we do live in a genuinely global system now. You know, these crises cannot be restrained within national economies and so forth. So that potential will arise. We've got to be prepared. Well, how are we prepared? Well, yeah, you've got to be organised, but the other way is you've got to be know what you want, and perhaps more particularly what you don't want, because there'll be all sorts of people coming up with solutions that are just going to lead you straight back from where you came from.
Okay, I've got 1, 2, and then 3. So,
quite sure what I'm going to say, but I want to refer back to your original question, which I don't feel is really being addressed, but how you feel. I think it's the responses have been about economic situations, and if I heard rightly, your question was more about, correct me if I'm wrong, but your question was more to do with why don't the people in this country respond in the same way as people do in other places, even, you know, France and Greece, and Thailand. What is it about our social conditioning that makes it difficult for us to get on the street, that makes it difficult for us to say, fuck you, we're going to go on strike anyway? You know, we don't care whether the High Court has said it's illegal, you know, if nothing is go on strike, the law becomes irrelevant. Is that what you were after? Yeah, I thought so. So, I'm not sure what the answer is to the question. I think it boils back to social conditioning and also confidence. I don't think that currently the angry working people, and there are a lot of angry working people, including anarchists, and not working people who are anarchists as well, so have the physical confidence and possibly the physical fitness to actually get up there and do what needs to be done. Maybe don't have the skills in speaking, don't have the skills in listening, those sorts of things. So maybe those are the issues that need to be addressed. As well as being an anarchist communist, I'm also an anarcho-feminist. I think that the anarchist movement has got a very, very strong male dominance at the moment. I worry that as a result of that, we're pushed into gender binaries and we stick in those and we don't support one another well enough. I would see that as a way forward, but within anarchism certainly, and outside of anarchism as well, that people support one another better and to develop physical fitness and confidence in being able to go on the street and being able to fight and being able to say, yeah, we are going to go on the street, fuck you. Not easy, but possibly was just an idea.
Okay, 1, 2, 3.
Yes.
I disagree. I think things are happening in this country that are happening in Thailand. If you take what happened with the red shirts, less than 5% of the population were involved in it. So it's a very small group. Just because it hit the headlines doesn't mean it was a big group. We've had the miners' strike. We got trashed in that. The red shirts got trashed. The BA strike that you mentioned. I'm in the same union as the BA workers, and the BA workers were going to go out and strike anyway. After the last court injunction, they were going to walk out anyway on a wildcat strike. The builders were on wildcat strikes during the building of the Channel Tunnel. So it does happen in this country, it's just you don't hear about it as much. So I think it's misleading sometimes to look at the other countries and go, oh, that's not happening here, because it is. It might be happening on a smaller scale sometimes. There's been occupations of schools, there's been occupations of factories. These things are going on. It's just the organisation needs to get bigger to encompass it all.
Okay.
I think the points that Donald made, the Green Anarchist, about things being in this bubble and not coming through yet is really true, because 2 years ago the government bailed out the banks and printed all this money, and every economist knows, looking at history, you print loads of money, it makes problems down the line. And the government didn't want to do anything about it. All the political parties know they've got to make absolutely massive cuts to their public spending. The government didn't want to do anything about it before the election because they knew they were already deeply unpopular and it would have been they got completely trashed. So now we're going to have massive public spending cuts. I don't think anyone has really got their heads around how deep these are going to be. And there's talk of Sheffield Council having to shed 50% of its spending. You can imagine like how that's going to happen. Where can the cuts be made? No one is going to take happily to anything being cut. People blame whatever happens, and that's when people will be out on the street. And that's what's happening in Greece. They've been told they've just got to slash public spending for the situation they were at. And it's got to happen in Britain. And none of the party, apparently the various manifestos, Labour outlined, they've all agreed how much needs to be cut. Labour outlined 5% of the cuts they're going to make in their manifesto. The Tories 8% and the Lib Dems 10%. And so there's 90% more cuts than they're going to have to make. And they all know this. And they just, yeah, people are going to be out on the streets then. Yeah, be prepared for it. Because other people are going to be coming up with solutions, like the BFP saying, we told you all along, let's blame asylum seekers, they've got to push into this mess. So the anarchists need to be prepared. And this shitstorm's coming in the next 12, 24 months, and it's going to be massive.
Thank you.
Yes,
All I was going to say is I think besides social conditioning, as you mentioned, I mean, there are historical factors, but I think there is certainly a lot of credibility to the idea that you mentioned, that basically where we haven't reached the same problems as Greece yet. I mean, I think that's most likely, probably definitely the case, and also the media attention as well. Greece has Greece was quite popularised, like, not popularised, but there was a lot in the media about it, and it was, you know, pictures of stuff on fire, and it was made quite a big dramatic thing out of it in the news, whereas here things tend to be downplayed, and I think it's because, basically because the media wants to portray things as going on in other countries and not going on here, which is why stuff that goes on in this country is very rarely mentioned, and when it is mentioned it's usually completely downplayed and almost unnoticed, and I think things are going on, it's just they aren't being reported on.
Okay, one or two.
I was thinking about what you were saying, and I only have a small question and somebody can answer. What would be the reaction of the public thought in England when if people go out to the street and have a manifestation? I'm talking about proper manifestation in the streets of thousands of people. What is the proper reaction of the state? Because I've never seen, I mean, when was the last time a manifestation happened in England? 92? I don't know. What would be the reaction of the public thought?
Does anybody want to come back with a direct response to, like, if there was a mass demonstration, mass mobilisation on the streets, what would the state's response be?
I know how it is where I come from, but I don't know how it works in England. It's a public force state, actual reactions against the people. It's an actual operation of the state against the people.
There's like there's stuff like the forward intelligence team and just shit that's right, it's, you know, what I've been experiencing is like I don't like if the people could outnumber them then great, but I'm not sure, you know, that would be a huge response. So basically massive amounts.
Okay, one and then two.
British police are actually the pioneers of what's known as the Kitson agenda. They allow large manifestations, as you put it, to happen, and then what they'll do is they'll go in and work out how to divide and how to cause splits to break it apart. It did classically to the communist groups in this country for years, just setting up fake splits, fake divisions, basically just to destroy the internal integrity. So they're quite on the hands thinking you wouldn't go quite often see it happen. Quite involved in the animal rights movement, which did have a large manifestation, and we definitely saw attempts to try and cause internal divisions and stuff going on. But I think that also ties into want to respond to what you're saying. It's like I come from Northern Ireland, where, you know, we did pick up arms and fight. And part of the reason we had that was there was incredibly strong communities. You know, the communities were really, really, you know, very close. They were found, you know, placed on blood. And so you had that confidence. You knew that when you went back to your places that, you know, you were going to be looked after. So people had much greater courage in going out because you did have that thing. And one of the things that, you know, started with... You know, capitalism loves to do is to atomize society, break everybody down to individual consumers. You know, and Thatcher said, you know, when she was, there's no such thing as society. You know, she wanted just consumers, and we've allowed that to happen. And only by actually rebuilding those communities, where people have the confidence to go out and get more militant. Having been involved in the militant groups, one of the things that was really strong about it was that sense of community. That if something did go wrong, I could disappear off. I would have people who would look after me, who would get me out of the country if necessary. Those structures existed. You know, they were built on, you know, common experience. Now, a lot of groups, a lot of people just don't have that experience, so they are lacking that. You know, if I go out and, you know, I'm in the middle of a riot situation, I throw some rocks at some cops. Cops single me out. Am I going to be protected? Are people going to gather around me and de-arrest me? You know, if you don't have that confidence, then you're not going to step up, you know, up to the situation. And that's quite an extreme, well, extreme, very commas, you know, example. But, you know, that goes through everybody's lives. We need to make sure that people, you know, have got those communities, those strong affinity groups that will take them, protect them.
Thank you. Okay
yeah, the British state is unbelievably clever. Yeah, And part of the way it functions is by tolerating and allowing signs of dissent, as long as that dissent only goes up to a certain point. So the new government that's come in has just announced that it's going to restore the right to demonstrate. You know, that's one of the first things it did, was restore the right to demonstrate, which presumably means demonstrating in Parliament Square, which the previous government outlawed. But the price for that is that the demonstration is policed by the people who are organising the demonstration themselves. Yeah, the response to by the British state to a militant series of demonstrations, possibly involving violence, would be probably acts of quite extreme brutality by the riot police on certain sections of the demonstration. It would be fairly quiet policing of other parts of the demonstration, and it would be followed up by months of repression. Yeah, because what happened in Manchester, in Oldham, when the riots took place 2000, when the riots took place there, the police were happy to contain the riots for the 2 or 3 days that they took place. Yeah, over the next 3 years, they examined their photographic evidence and they just arrested, in the community that was involved, somewhere between 30 and 40 young men were arrested and sent to prison for 3 and 4 years at a time. Yeah. Now, a very clear message has been given to that community, right? Which is, you know, behave yourselves or your young men will go to prison for a long time. Yeah. And that community is far less militant now, because again, the policing was, it was a violent demonstration, petrol bombs, attacks on the police, very few arrests took place at that time. Yeah. Although the police were prepared to go in and, you know, waving truncheons and the like. Even if people were de-arrested at the time, they were later picked off by sophisticated policing. So that, in my opinion, would be the likely response to any kind of violent manifestations on the street. The question is, what happens after the one demonstration? Does it then lead on to another one, another one, another one, another one? If the struggle escalates, then those taking part are relatively safe. If the struggle fails to escalate, then those taking place are vulnerable at later stages. And of course, don't forget that the left will be there shopping us. Yeah, they've done it. They did it in Leeds to Anarchist Federation member against the EDL. Militant tried to do it in the poll tax riot. They offered to shop the rioters to the police. They're the Socialist Party now, aren't they? And they'll be there busy cooperating and helping. But yeah, that's my feeling on it.
Now, we've gone slightly over, just if people are concerned about the time, because the next meeting has been cancelled. So if people want to say anything else within this meeting... Otherwise, do we want to get the panel members just to sum anything up at all, just to finish off?
I'm happy with the way the discussion's gone. I'm not an expert that has anything particular to offer that's going to bring pearls of wisdom for everybody, so no.
Okay, that's great. Thanks everybody for coming and participating.